Our New Testament lesson this morning comes from the book of Revelation, chapter 21, verses 1 through 6. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them as their God. They will be his peoples, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. For the first things have passed away. And the one who was seated on the throne said, See, I am making all things new. And he said, Write this, for these words are trustworthy and true. Then he said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water as a gift from the spring of the water of life. May God bless to our understanding this reading from God's word. Chuck Pierce's son was concerned. Like a lot of other people looking out on a world of ransacked grocery stores and canceled sports seasons and eerie lines of people standing 6 feet apart from one another. So he asked his dad, Is this the end of the world? That's a question you can ask when you have a dad who calls himself an apostolic prophet and leads a prophetic ministry as a Christian evangelical. No, said Pierce, who is based in Corinth, Texas. The Lord's shown me through 2026, so I know this isn't the end of time. The worldwide upheaval caused by the fast-spreading coronavirus pandemic has many people reaching for the Bibles, and some starting to wonder, could this be a sign of the apocalypse? It sure might feel apocalyptic, but not if you ask Christian writers and pastors who have spent years focusing their message on a literal interpretation of the book of Revelation, the New Testament's final book. According to them, it lays out a lurid, poetic vision of the end times, which some evangelical leaders interpret to mean that Jesus will return to earth, believers will be raptured to heaven, and those left behind will suffer 7 dreadful years of calamities. Most of these Revelation-focused prophesiers don't see the coronavirus as heralding the second coming and the end of life on earth as we know it. Such was the conclusion of a Washington Post article this week, which interviewed a host of end-time prophets and scholars around the country. Pastor Pierce, the prophet I just quoted, said he understands why Americans might fear this time of fast encroaching disease, isolation from loved ones, and crashing stock markets as apocalyptic. Americans are primed to believe the end of the world might arrive any day now. In 2010, an astonishing 41% of us told the Pew Research Center that they expected Jesus to return by 2050. Huge segments of Christianity have, in my view, wasted a great deal of time trying to take this fantastic, poetic, and quixotic book of Revelation literally. Various Christian groups believe that Revelation is a puzzle in which every element describes a particular event that has happened or must happen. Many of these Christians believe that if we can just break the code, we will know where and when Christ will return, fight the battle, defeat death, and usher in the new creation. Literal readings of Revelation have led to the creation of communities like the Shakers and to denominations like the Seventh-day Adventists, where Christian faith and practice are formed by waiting for Christ's imminent return. It has also led to dangerous political strategies such as the active support of armament sales to Israel by various fundamentalist Christian groups. They support these measures so that an army will be ready to fight the final battle with Satan in the Jezreel Valley, which is not far from Jerusalem. As Presbyterians, we come from a part of the Christian tradition that has shown little interest in the book of Revelation, at least from the standpoint of reading it as a holy code which, once broken, will predict the future. Most of us standing in the Reformed tradition argue that the future is in God's hands, and that what is important is the essence of this promise from God, and not the roadmap or the timetable. Now, having said that, it may be easy for some of us to forget the promise by getting hung up on where or when this particular natural disaster will happen, including the one we are in now, fits into the sequence described in the Bible. We may lose sight of the power of the vision. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth have passed away, and the sea was no more. The writer of these words was himself the victim of war, an exile, a prisoner in a hopeless situation. He was a Jewish Christian by the name of John, living a generation after Jesus. In fact, he may have known Jesus. He's the author of the book of Revelation. His world had collapsed. The capital of his nation, Jerusalem, was gone, flattened, burned, utterly destroyed in the year 70 of the Common Era by the Romans, who had finally tired of the protests and political demonstrations and revolts and riots among their Jewish subjects. So the Roman legions gathered and invaded and chased up and down the countryside troublemakers, revolutionaries, and everyone who was out of line, killing every last one in the process, cornering a group of refugee Jews in the fortress at Masada, a dramatic high mountain plateau where several hundred people lived under siege for several years and finally committed suicide rather than surrender. And then there's Jerusalem. Jerusalem, the home of every Jewish heart, the capital, the city of David's throne and Solomon's temple, the symbol of God's love and presence and providence. Jerusalem and its temple had been leveled, its citizens either executed or driven into exile. It was Rome's version of the final solution. The Christian community, too, insofar as it was identified with Judaism, was violently persecuted, its leaders either executed, imprisoned, or exiled. And so it was that an old man by the name of John found himself far from home, a prisoner on the small island of Patmos near Greece. I've been told that when you visit Patmos, you can see a monastery on the spot John was thought to have been imprisoned, and the cave where he was chained to the wall with the shackles still there. And across the dark, low cave on the other side, a small opening through which the prisoner could breathe fresh air and see a slice of brilliant blue sky and sea. John's world had collapsed. His religion, the faith of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and David, was being systematically stamped out by the most powerful, violent political entity the world had ever known. His new faith in Jesus, the Jewish carpenter, rabbi, crucified by Rome, was also now being systematically persecuted. Christians, along with Jews, were arrested, executed, or imprisoned as traitors to the Roman state. They were weak, powerless, without resources or friends, or, frankly, much hope. John wanted to write a letter of encouragement to his friends under persecution. He looked out at that tiny opening in his prison cell, saw the sky, the sea, and wrote striking words that somehow were smuggled out of his prison and given to the world. "I saw a new heaven and a new earth," he wrote. And he reached back centuries into the history of his people, all the way back to the prophet Isaiah, who had described Jerusalem as a joy and a delight. Now John, in his hopeless situation, has a vision, a new Jerusalem, coming down from heaven. And then he wrote powerful words that people who themselves were or are up against hopeless odds would turn to gratefully. Prisoner of war, political exile, terminally ill person, son, daughter, husband, wife, partner, friend, keeping watch as a dear one declines and dies. Coronavirus victim, and you and I, as we ponder the great imponderable of our own aging and immortality, and immortality. See, the throne of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away. We often read these words at memorial services, at the very moment when thoughtful and sensitive people find themselves experiencing the pain of grief and separation and ending, find themselves wondering about the purpose of it all, wondering about the human prospect. John dared to see a vision of what God has in mind for the world. That vision transcends the immediacy of the present, transcended his own dreadful situation. That bold vision is of a new heaven and a new earth, a new Jerusalem, the promise of a new order where there will be no more weeping, no more injustice, no more oppression, no more cruelty and persecution, no more racism, no more unkindness, no more war, no more disease, and no more death. God will tenderly wipe the very tears from the eyes of the precious suffering, whomever they are. Is this the delusion of a frail, dying old man? No, we Christians believe that it is truth, precious truth, powerful truth. Those who die do not die in vain. No one dies into nothingness. The natural limit that shapes the life of every conscious being, the boundary of everything that lives, will be removed, and there will be only life. Tears and pain will be no more, because the things that break our hearts and break our bodies will have come to an end. You know, we need this vision because it reminds us that these very things, tears and pain, suffering and grief, are not God's plan for God's creation. What the book of Revelation sees is a city, the New Jerusalem. It has often been remarked that the Bible begins in the garden and ends in the city. When God comes to dwell with the new humanity in the new creation, they are not back in the Garden of Eden, but in the city, in the very place most symbolic of human ingenuity, human initiative, and human creativity. Ironically, the city, any city, is also the place today where humans are most susceptible to the spread of COVID-19 and most in need of recapturing this divine vision. Have you ever noticed that the cartoons about people meeting St. Peter at the pearly gates often show a disconnected portion of fencing with a gate set on a bed of clouds? The whole point of the gate is that it leads into the city. Go to Jerusalem today and you will enter the old city through one of its several gates. God's promise is not a return to the creation God originally designed, but the renewal, the renovation, if you will, of the human design, the city. In the 1960s, a young theologian by the name of Harvey Cox wrote a book that made him famous for the rest of his life. The Secular City, he called it, and it was a stunning analysis of the challenge of urbanization and secularization for American religious life. The massive migration of population from rural to urban centers, Cox argued, would cut the nerve of traditional religion. City life would bring people out of religious and cultural enclaves into contact with one another, and thus weaken the hold of traditional lifestyles and signal the demise of religion as we know it. While many of Cox's observations and predictions have been realized, and while life in urban America is fraught with challenge and sometimes with danger, religion has not departed from the American landscape, nor has God departed from the city. As we move through these opening decades of the 21st century, the majority of people in the United States, indeed in the world, live in cities. The ancient promise of Revelation thus has new power and import. The new heaven and new earth. The new heaven and the new earth is the home of the city. God recreates not only God's natural creation, but ours as well. The branch of Christian faith where we Presbyterians make our home believes that the promises of God are, on the one hand, convictions about what God will do, and on the other, outlines for what we are to do while waiting for God's promises to be fulfilled. The vision of a safe and beautiful city in which all peoples come and where they will live in peace and safety is a challenge to us today as we live in our cities in the midst of a global pandemic. We who share the vision of divine intention for the city must now help shape the city. If we sing about the streets of heaven, we must work for safe streets. If we believe that God will wipe away every tear, we must make sure there are no homeless or hungry people and no abandoned children. In the midst of this global pandemic, our lethargy about the state of our society is being profoundly challenged. We know there are critical shortages of medical supplies and possibly hospital beds in the coming weeks and months. And so we must demand that our government, in concert with the private sector, now mobilize in a way we haven't done since World War II to meet these pressing needs, along with other needs we will face as we move forward. But looking longer term, is it really acceptable for this nation to have the highest percentage of our population in prison than any Western democracy? Is it acceptable for death by gunfire to be a leading cause of death among children? Is it acceptable that during this time when we must close the public schools for valid public health concerns, 30 million low-income children who rely on free breakfast and lunch programs in the schools will be without those meals? Churches like ours, in partnership with the local community, must rally with food and donations and to make sure these children are adequately fed, and we are doing exactly that in our own neighborhood right now. You know, there is so much you and I simply do not meet on a daily basis, so much we don't see, so much we take for granted. What we need, I think, is a little bit of holy dissatisfaction, the sense that things are not as they should be, not as God intends, and not what God has promised. How do you hope? That question was asked Thursday evening on the network news by a mother who was worried about her children. We hope because we have been given a vision of a new Jerusalem. We hope because we believe the vision comes from God and carries God's power to make it come to pass in partnership with us. I pray that each day in the coming weeks and months will be an opportunity to hear again the call of the one who has promised to make everything fresh and new. And on that day, when it is accomplished, all of us can pray joyfully. Finish then thy new creation, pure and spotless let it be. Let us see thy great salvation, perfectly restored in thee. Amen.